There we go. And this recording will be made available to everybody that's registered. So for those people who have just joined us, welcome to the Future Leaders webinar with Identec. My name is Ian Parry, and I'll be your host. Today we're asking the question, is the energy sales market dead? Today I'm joined by James Miles from Microsoft, Shar Bunce from PE Solutions, Wayne Mitchell from Darlington Energy, Pete Lees from Summit Flow, and Gemma Hill from Identec. Hi, panel. Looking forward to getting into the discussion with you all today. So it's a very much a hand-picked panel with a variety of experience from sales operations to strategy, from residential sales to business and I&C sales as well. So we've got a real mixed bag of expertise today, and we've got a load of different questions to get into. If you want to lodge a question as we go in, please pop into the comments and I'll do what I can to make sure we navigate our way through the webinar to cover those questions. As I mentioned earlier, if we don't get through all the questions, then I'll make sure that we come back to you folks after the webinar. As I said, if you can stay on mute for the time that we're into the panel conversation and turn your cameras off as well, that'll just protect the bandwidth of the call for the panelists. So let's jump into the first question then. So we're starting with you then, Wayne. So in your opinion, is the energy sales market dead?
Thanks, Ian, and hello, everyone. Well, it can't possibly be, because if it was dead, then none of the energy businesses would be selling anything to anyone. So my short and glib answer to that is, well, no, it's not dead. I think what is dead, though, are what I would call low engagement sales. So there was a time, years and perhaps even decades past, where energy businesses would make quick, transactional, cheap sales to relatively poorly informed customers. So for me, that world is long gone. I think we're in a world now where, regardless of which channel you use, whether that's through a consultant, whether it's through some kind of web switching platform, whether it's direct with an energy business, the average buyer is now better informed. They're much more engaged, especially since the energy crisis. And whichever route they go through, they're looking for a high engagement sale. So what does that mean? It could mean a number of things. It means they're highly engaged with the market and they understand, and so they expect their counterpart to understand the market and give them insight. I think it's built on longer term relationships and businesses going back to businesses that might have supplied them previously, where they know and trust them. And it's also a market where that engagement comes through creativity of the products that you're selling as well. So there has to be something extra. But summary for me, transactional, low engagement, transactional, commoditized sales, they're long gone as far as I'm concerned.
Great. Good summary there, Wayne. Thanks for that. Shar, anything to add to that from your perspective? Sorry, Shar, you're on mute.
Sorry, my mistake. Sorry, no, afternoon all. No, the only comment I've got to make is wish I'd gone first, because Wayne, you've covered off pretty much everything that I would say. There's a few semantics in there. We've got to have more cohesion between suppliers, which is my side, and the partners, brokers, consultants, whatever label we wish to put. Semantics. Sales for us is about relationship management, whether that's with direct customers, with our partners. I think that's really important, because that opens up communication, trust, negotiations can be so much more commercially aware. Customers are aware, albeit we are fighting poor media coverage, but all sorts of customers, small, I&C, mid-market, they are very much aware. And just because we are in a world where we've got products that people need doesn't mean that our customer service should be any less. In fact, it should be better. The onus isn't just on price now, it's about additional products like day ahead or time of use, not just for I&C customers, but for the whole portfolio. Why should that not be available? Customers are making informed decisions and they do have a much better sense of empowerment as long as they're getting the right professional advice from people who not only balance their commercial and business models, but also an element of a moral compass. And those aren't words that are often used in our world. So yeah, I support everything that Wayne says there. It's a very different picture, and we have to approach it far more professionally.
Cool. Thank you, Sean. And James, obviously, you're you're coming at it from a different perspective now that you're in your role at Microsoft. Is there anything you would add that hasn't been mentioned?
Yeah, I think it's been well covered so far, so I don't have a huge amount to add. I think we're certainly seeing not the death of energy sales, but an evolution. I think we've already mentioned the fact that traditional transactional fixed price contracts are just not necessarily effective for people anymore, and people are looking more for flexible strategies and greener options. But we're seeing big regulatory shifts as well in the market, not just in the UK but outside of the UK, and market fluctuations. And I think actually I'd argue that the situation is probably more costly, complex, and urgent than it's ever been. And I think that suggests there's actually a bright future for energy sales. But kind of further to the way that we interact with prospects and consumers, I think it's really important for consultancies and suppliers to really showcase their differences, because my experience in senior consultancy roles taught me that standing out is absolutely essential. And I think often prospects perceive consultancies as identical, and the only real difference setting them apart is their logos. And I think the same can be said to an extent for suppliers. I think it's about embracing adaptability, carving out a niche, and fostering innovation. You can't stand still for a moment. So whilst there is plenty of opportunity out there, I just really feel like you really need to get ahead of the game and constantly move and innovate.
Yeah, absolutely. And just staying on that theme for a second then, James, what sort of changes have you seen across the market since the sort of the major price rises of 2021? So for those not in the industry, this is the sort of the time period where we saw most companies exiting the market, because they weren't able to sort of keep pace with the sort of the price controls that Ofgem were put into the marketplace. So what sort of changes have you seen since then, James?
So yeah, I'd say there's quite a few, really. I mean, my focus is on the EMEA region now, so I'm kind of aware of how costs and geopolitics and EU regulations really kind of swayed the wider energy landscape. I think the conflict in Ukraine and reducing Russia's gas supply, I think from about 40% to 16% into Europe, that's pretty seismic. And I think that, coupled with both the regulatory and voluntary net zero commitments that we're seeing since these market shifts, is really shaping how users use energy, but also how they procure it as well. And I think it underscores how important it is to have a robust strategy, and one that really prioritizes stability and innovation. And I think this is an area where TPIs are thinking about my consultancy background. That's where they can be a real light in the dark when supporting their clients. I think consumers now, for those that can adjust their consumption patterns, we're seeing that happen, certainly. And consumers want to be empowered. They want kind of relevant, actionable options to look at energy efficiency measures so that they can become less reliant on grid-connected supplies. Certainly, that's what we're seeing. And I think when prices really started to skyrocket, we saw consumers really start to see the ROI on self-generation stack up, and perhaps they hadn't seen that before. So that's one kind of positive, I guess, to the increase in the prices. But we also saw consumers start to renegotiate their supply contracts as well to mitigate upside cost risk. So for some businesses that were purely index linked, they wanted the option to hedge some of their volume. And then we saw energy suppliers, to your point, there, Ian, around kind of shifts in the market from an energy supplier perspective. We saw suppliers enforcing seldom use clauses because they were having to cope with a price shock that they hadn't dealt with before. So we're certainly seeing quite a lot of market shifts in the last few years.
Cool. Thank you, James.
Ian, could I just intervene and follow up on
Yeah,
what James has said there? Because you made
absolutely.
a really key point. It is about the ROI on energy efficiency projects. And I've seen exactly the same thing, that there were clients that I work with where they had projects for whatever it is, an LED refit or voltage optimization or self-generation PV, whatever it was, that it might have been dead. And then suddenly, the energy crisis has reinvigorated that business case, because suddenly, almost overnight, the ROI is back into a world where it can compete with other projects around the business. So that was a very definite shift, and I've seen a much, much greater interest in the demand side, which, when the market was flat and benign, it was a real struggle to get anyone to take notice of that and to plan for the future. So, excuse my French, it's given the industry a bit of a kick up the arse to get projects done, to be honest, to give them that certainty, give them that predictability and that protection.
Yeah, absolutely, Wayne. Good point. And have you seen that continuing now that price is a little bit more stable? Are those sort of projects still happening?
Yes, they are. And I think the prices are still, given where we were before the energy crisis, where were we, like 40, £50 per megawatt hour? We're still in the 70, 80, £90 per megawatt hour, depending on which season you're buying. So the business cases, they absolutely still stack up. But I think, back to what I was saying before, people are a lot better informed, a lot more engaged. And I think now businesses that I deal with, they're looking at, how do I protect myself from any future market shock? Because I think, again, when the market was benign, people look at it and think, well, what's going to happen? It's all fine out here. And then suddenly, market events lead us to a 10 times multiple of energy, of wholesale energy price. So there's a definite focus on protecting themselves from future events.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Wayne. Just moving back to you then, Shah, thinking about some of the work that Ofgem have been doing in this space, as they've started to try and introduce some regulation into the TPI world. Have you seen that impacting sales volumes in your business, or is it still pretty stable?
It's still pretty stable, actually, Ian. So any impact tends to be sort of on the brokers, and obviously we use these words carefully. TPI is brokers consultants, and what Wayne and James are talking about is consultancy, where you've got an overarching a pilot view of how customers need to be managed and should be managed. So I think we've seen, again, we don't see it so much as a supplier because we've got our supplier license regulations that we've got to abide to anyway, and there has to be a level of transparency. I personally am quite pleased it's a transparency and it makes it more legitimate. I think it's long overdue. However, if I was speaking to some brokers of TPIs, they would be telling me the opposite. So, I can only speak from a supplier's perspective. I think, again, going back to customer, the customers are much more aware. We need to have that more sort of consultative approach. And then you can justify whatever levels of commission have been shown and identified within a contract, and a customer then feels comfortable. There are hundreds of commission claims going through Ofgem at the moment, and it's just sort of wait and see what the general feeling about that is. But I think most customers are highly aware that consultants particularly are going over and above and doing all the things that James and Wayne have just sort of mentioned. Again, we've got poor media reporting, which is always a bit of a hurdle because we're always seen as the bad guys, whether it's consultants or suppliers, and we need to sort of shift through that and make our case and be different and be better.
Yeah, absolutely. And are you finding now that people that you're working with, is there a lot more due diligence going on when you're selecting partners now, or has that always been the case and it's just, as you say, some poor reporting?
I've got to be mindful of what I say here, really. There are people who have got very high levels of due diligence, and those are the consultants that we're more than happy to work with. There are other brokers with different business models, and they have to take ownership of that responsibility because the buck lands with them. As long as we're doing the right thing as a supplier and abiding by our regulations and our restrictions and our licenses, then that's the stuff we have to take. That has to be the line that's drawn.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Sean. Just moving on now then into something a little bit more practical. So we've set the scene, we kind of see where the market is at the moment and some of the changes that we've seen. We've asked the provocative question as to whether the energy sales market is dead. Wayne's come out with a really strong position and everybody's kind of piled on and said, actually, no, it's pretty energetic, actually. So getting into the practicalities of selling in this space now then, jump into you, Pete. What do you see are the sort of pitfalls to look for when using data to target sort of new prospects and customers?
Well, we all know the market can be both dynamic and volatile. So I'd say in regards to data, we need data management teams to make sure that the methods of they're using for sort of collecting and analyzing data is constantly evolving and keeping up with market conditions. So that's the first thing I'd say. And then I'd say also, like with leveraging new technology, there's loads of companies out there using sort of machine learning and artificial intelligence to sort of analyze large data sets, predict market trends and sort of detect any anomalies. So I think, using new tech is going to be huge moving forward. And then just, making sure just, not so much, this is less on the futuristic side, this is sort of legacy. It's just ensuring the return of investment versus the costs. So, the companies I've worked with, I don't think, in the past I've worked with sort of British Gas, Scottish Power, there's varying differentiation between the amount of sort of siloed focus on certain data sets and how them data sets are managed. So, it's super important because it's not just about the data cost itself, it's the utilization of the data as well. So like a good example of that would be, have you got the skill set in-house to get the most out of that data? And, have you got the contact cadence strategy in place to be able to contact that data opportunity at the right time and then follow up when you need to follow up on it? So there's loads of considerations to making sure that, there's a lot to consider when buying data because it's expensive to maintain, expensive to buy, it's expensive to analyze. And sometimes companies are not ready for some of the better data sources. So it's just making sure that the right things are done at the right times, I guess.
Okay. Thanks, Pete. Appreciate that. James, just moving to you then. Obviously, again, you come at this market quite differently to the rest of the panel. What sort of pitfalls have you avoided in the past or even fallen into that you feel comfortable sharing?
Yeah, I think to Pete's point around, being wary and using data in the right way is really important. I think for me, it's about keeping it quite basic and quite simple. Getting the basics right is really important. So I think an over-reliance on kind of averages and quantitative data is really something to be avoided. I think that offers a good foundation and it gives you a good idea of what your target list looks like. But I don't think you should rely on that on its own. I think qualitative data is really important too. And I think the more research that you can do and the more targeted you can be about what are your customers' needs, their preferences, I think that leads to more effective prospecting. So you can't ignore qualitative insights for sure. I think that's the critical thing. I think a combination of both is really important when you're refining your target list. I mean, I suppose the most recent example I can think of was when I was designing a value proposition for data centers in my previous role. And I started out with a lot of assumptions, even though I felt like I knew the market and I'd kind of got that kind of basic data on what do data centers face on a day-to-day basis, what are their drivers, who are the key people within those data centers that can really kind of, and I can enhance a product with. And I think I made those assumptions and it was really evident in my first iteration of that value proposition that actually I'd made far too many assumptions based on that data. And thankfully I had the sort of relationship with my existing clients that I could speak directly to them. And I think you've got to remember, it's not just your direct contacts, it's people within the business that they can link you up with that can really give you that nuanced idea of what is it that's going to really kind of hit home with this prospect group. And I think that collaboration was really instrumental. And my final proposition was significantly different by the end and really impactful because of that.
Cool. Thank you, James. Dive in, Ryan.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, as you're speaking then, James, I wrote down on my pad the phrase assume nothing, and then you kind of came to that point anyway. But for me, that comes from having dealt with a whole variety of businesses, even in the same sector, and just because they're in the same sector, it is meaningless. So I've worked in businesses where they had a slight obsession with what they call vertical segments, where, whatever it is, food retail and engineering and whatever else. But once you get into those sectors, now, the example I'll give you is in the supermarket sector. So I've worked with as a supplier and as prospects with pretty much most of the main UK food retailers over the years. And yes, they open at broadly the same times, but their estate and their attitude to buying energy is completely different. So on the data side of it, if depends on the hours that they run their refrigeration, depends what on-site generation they've got, depends whether they've got a bakery, depends on their lighting levels, depends on their footfall, so on, their data could actually be quite, somewhat different from the next the next food retailer that you deal with. But the key thing is some of that qualitative stuff. So it comes down to their appetite for risk and their buyer behavior. So do they have a high appetite for risk and a short-term decision-making process, or do they have a low appetite for risk and a long contract tenor that they're willing to engage with? So the outcome, as I think you were saying, James, is what you might expect, and then the outcome that you come up with can be very, very different, even though on the face of it, they look like they're exactly the same kind of business. So you know, all I would say is, yeah, again, assume nothing. Unearth the data that you think is going to give you the raw materials to come up with a quotation and a proposal, but react to what you see in front of you and try and really get behind that data and propose something bespoke to that client. Don't assume that you can just do something generic and it will do the job, because I don't think it will.
Thank you, Wayne. Now, Gemma, I'd like to sort of pull you in at this point, actually. So obviously data is kind of your day-to-day job, but you've also got some incredible experience in sales and marketing in previous roles. Is there anything you'd like to kind of share at this point on this question?
Well, it was a lovely intro. Thank you. That's picked me up more than I deserve, I think. I think if we are rightly looking at a situation where we've got a more informed client base, that necessitates a more informed and consultative sales process, which again is longer and of a higher skill set. So to be able to do that in terms of frontline sales, frontline managers, you need to make sure that the basics are right to be able to not only extend that process and make it more consultative, but also make sure that conversion levels stay the same. And for me, that starts with making sure that the data is bang up to date and completely clean, or as clean as it can be. The turnover in terms of businesses, new businesses starting, businesses moving, circumstance changing, business leaders changing, needs changing. If we're giving our sales teams data on that basis that is clean, that they can call with confidence, that allows for a longer sales process. It allows for it to be more consultative, but it also takes out a lot of wasted time in that process going through data where that business is not there anymore, that person's changed, those circumstances are different. So from a very sort of frontline basis, if you make sure that that data is clean and up to date, it therefore allows your sales teams to do that longer sales process, to do that consultative process, and to be suggesting packages that are right for that customer based on being able to have more time on the phone, more time in front of them, because they've had the confidence to call that person, to knock on that door and know who's there.
Yeah. And there's certainly in my experience working with sales folks, there's nothing that they find more frustrating than a like data that just doesn't exist anymore. Knocking on a door or picking up the phone and just finding out that it's not the right information and feeling, you know, frustrated or foolish that they're not dealing with the right company or individual.
Absolutely. And if we're looking for our sales teams to be more informed, to match the level of knowledge that the potential client base has got, you're starting off on the bad foot if you call someone and ask for the wrong person, or you get the business name wrong. So it's about that, keeping that level of professionalism, knowing who you're calling, knowing where your data is, knowing that it's up to date, knowing that it's correct. That allows for better customer service, better conversion, and a better experience for customers, which I think we've all agreed throughout this is key at the minute.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, and we don't talk about this often enough, I think, the experience of the salesperson, because as you've rightly said, if they're feeling confident in the data, they're going to squeeze it for everything that it's got. And if they're feeling good about the experience they're getting, then their performance is going to be in a better place as well.
Yeah, totally. If you look at a model where a lot of data is self-genned, the amount of time that it takes someone to Google to find an active trading business could be spent on looking at that business sector, looking at the right package for that person, for that company. So if you've got confidence, efficiency, it increases productivity and it also increases customer experience, which has a knock-on effect for sales retention as well.
Cool. Thank you, Gemma. So getting further into this sales world then, folks, I'm really interested in what we can share with people attending today from a, setting up a new team. And what you've all learned over the years, good and bad. So just coming to you, James, first. So what are the sort of things that you would want to share as far as setting up a new team is concerned in a sales function?
Yeah, so I think to Gemma's point, I think that's a really important one. Rubbish in, rubbish out is critical, and I think you start with kind of good quality data. And I think, it's very easy to lose credibility, and data is essentially your foot in the door at the start of the sales process. So as you're making that initial contact, if you don't have the right details, it's difficult to come back from that. And if you wanted to portray yourself as a professional business, then that's really difficult. So that's really critical at the outset, is making sure that the data is there. I think the second thing is about focusing on identifying the values that align with your company's objectives and the specific needs of your customer. I mentioned kind of at the start how important it is really to kind of get that bit right and to really stand out from the crowd. But I think that's such an important point. As a user of energy services at Microsoft, I mean, I'm far more receptive to sellers that clearly understand the organization. They know what our priorities are and can demonstrate that there's alignment there. That goes a long, long way. And I think it goes without saying, but it's important to cover the full value chain. So if you're setting up a new sales process, we've already mentioned it's more complex out there for consumers now. Really need to make sure that you're touching on, yes, a procurement strategy, but you need to be able to provide really good advice. We're dealing with a client market now that are far more well informed. We've all been talking about how important it is to make sure that we're staying on top of that. But I think we need to be able to demonstrate that you can enable reaction to regulatory change and giving people the data that they need in order to actually make a difference to their business when it comes to today's energy market, particularly if you're a SME or you've got a larger market segment. But I think another important aspect is in kind of delivering services to your existing clients. I think it's an old adage, but it's true. It's far cheaper to keep a client than to get a new one. And I think any sales process needs to incorporate your existing client book. And I think your ability to offer additional services that create a strategic partnership, particularly as when we're talking about PPAs and things like that, that last kind of decades long, you really want to focus on that growth and retention. And I'm a huge advocate for real relationship management strategy. So for me, it's kind of a process within a process. And I think investing in people that nurture your client relationships is absolutely critical. And a lot of businesses talk a good game on it, but only a few really understand how to deliver it. So I think it's really important that those aspects are really key. And this might sound strange coming from an AI advocate and Microsoft employee, given that we're on the precipice of an AI revolution, but be wary of automation. I think there's a lot of automation in sales right now. And I think you've got to be really careful that you don't replace that human element of sales, because I've been in sales for a long time, and those authentic connections with prospects, they really build trust and loyalty, and they're absolutely key to success. And I think it's those parts that really make sales experiences memorable for the right reasons. So be wary of that. And I think this might be controversial in the sense that I'm grouping these together now, but ensuring alignment between sales, marketing, and retention efforts, I think, is really vital, because you can't have a cohesive strategy, in my opinion, without those things. And I think the best sales processes start with the end in mind. And by that, I mean successful processes that integrate acquisition and retention strategies. So I think understanding your audience, optimizing your touch points, and delivering value consistently is really, really important. And those are the things that sustain growth. All three teams need to work together, really, to maintain that consistent messaging. And I think that really helps build a good sales process end to end.
Yeah, some really good stuff there, James. And I like the idea of being really focused on the people within that team, and you kind of call out real relationship management as opposed to you know, people just having those as titles and never really being able to have the time to dedicate to the relationships and knitting it together really well.
Yeah, I think that's a really important thing. I think with a sales process, the focus, quite rightly, because it's a critical thing to growth, is focused on new business, and that, you know, that makes complete sense, but never at the expense, in my opinion, at least, of your retention of those clients, because that's really gonna, your long-term value of clients and your long-term business success is really critical. And it's so about the people that are on the ground that are interacting with your clients on a day-to-day basis. It's so important to make sure they have the time to develop good strategies, good account plans, and be really meticulous. It's hard work. It's not easy to have a really robust relationship management strategy, and it takes work every single day. And I think sometimes it can kind of drop off the priority list as people focus more on new business. But for me, that's that's the last thing you should do.
Cool. Thanks, James. Now, Wayne, James has covered off so many really good things there. Has he left you any wiggle room to add your own view on this question?
I reckon there's a few things, Ian. But I'll start off by agreeing on your point. And remember, my background is all at the top end of B2B sales, so that's where my focus has been, and my comments come from that. But first point is totally agree. That point about the human touch, I think. Certainly in the B2B space, the commercial relationships that I've seen that are the most robust come from that a very good human touch, human relationship that exists built on trust and integrity. So absolutely, that underpins any of those sales. I think the kind of people that you deal with in that space, they will smell automation from a country mile away, and it's just not engaging. Yeah, it might be useful because it gives you insights, but in terms of engaging with people, I don't think you can automate that, in my opinion. So my few bullet points that I've jotted down on this question are, and some of them are very simple. And you know, if you think, oh, well, that's obvious, well, fine, I get it. But I think that's what a sales process should be built on. So first thing, be really, really clear on what you're offering and to whom and why. Very, very simple. Second point, think about the customer, linked to the first, think about the customer pain points that you're taking away. Because that then is linked to my third point, which is how do you make the decision maker look like a superhero? So if you can take away customer pain and make that decision maker look like a superhero, it will be an obvious choice to come to you. Fourth point, I think you probably covered it, James, but don't make things too elaborate. Yeah, a 1,000-step sales process, absolutely never going to work. Yeah, remember, in your sales process, you need your human beings and your colleagues to carry out those steps. And if there's 1,000 of them, it will never happen. Make it as few steps as you possibly can. Last few things. Number five is don't be afraid to be patient. So especially in the B2B space, there's an example that I've jotted down here. A UK major infrastructure business, one of the biggest electricity users in the UK. It took us 10 years. From first engagement to actually winning a substantial piece of business, because they were already in contract. But when they do move their business, they need to be absolutely 100% certain they're moving it to somewhere that's going to be reliable and capable. So we nurtured that relationship for a decade and then finally won it. So you don't always have to be a decade patient, but be patient. It doesn't always happen immediately. On the flip side, be decisive. If you've got a prospect in your portfolio, or a suspect even, that is clearly a time waster, knock it out, get rid of it, because you can spend so much time going round and round in circles with someone that's never, ever going to transact with you. Just be decisive and get rid of it. The final thing I would say in a sales process, arguably one of the most important, is when you're actually engaging with clients, always, always, always give first. Give them something that shows them that you're capable, that you're knowledgeable, that you've got access to insight and information that you're willing to share, that gives them that evidence that through the life of any relationship that you form, you'll continue to feed them with insights that help them make the best decisions and help their business make the best decisions. So yeah, work out what that is and give that first. And that'll be your first step on building trust and engagement with that client.
Great. Thanks, Wayne. Some really good additions there. I guess I just want to throw this open to the rest of the panel now then. Is there anything anybody else would like to add on top of what James and Wayne have shared on as far as sales process and sales experience you've picked up over the years that you think would be worthwhile to share with the listeners today.
Yeah, one point I was going to say, and it follows on from a point that James made very well, was the close-knit relationships between sort of sales, marketing, and retention is super important, because one of the decision any new sales process that an energy company sort of embarks on is, first of all, are they going to keep it as an internal operation, or are they going to go outsourced? So depend like both options have pros and cons. Obviously, if you're going outsource, it's going to be harder to have that relationship with the marketing team and to get everybody on the same page. There's a decision to be made there. And I don't know who it was exactly, but they touched on, the people element, the training and development, and so on. What I've noticed, slightly different experience to Wayne, like I manage more B2C operations, larger scale. So in regards to sort of talent acquisition, there was always sort of a challenge, because you've got sort of a recruitment merry-go-round, and you sort of see the same names, same faces. So, what we've done in previous, what I've done in previous outsources is try to get sort of more of an academy basis and try to bring people in to the industry that have never been in the industry before, to try and see if you can source new talent. And there's so much technology that can support with that at the moment. So, like, there's a SaaS company in America now that does basically AI bots that you can pitch to, and they sort of value proposition is that they can get you 6 months worth of experience in 2 weeks, and so on. So it's being able to, find people and talent that, might not be in the industry at the moment, and bring them into the industry and get them up to speed as quickly as possible using that tech. So I just wanted to add that.
Yeah, thanks, Pete. Shah, did you want to say something? Sorry, you can't
Yeah, I
mute.
just wanted to say on the back of what James has just said, keeping a sales process really, really straightforward, because we've got to remember we are the energy experts. The man who's got the small workshop or has got, 400 manufacturing sites, they're busy running their own, doing their own thing. So we need to go to them, this face-to-face, this relationship word that we keep using. And that obviously, has a massive impact upon renewals, as James again said. Why would you want to lose a renewal? You're just giving something away. But we've got to remember we're the experts. We need to dumb it down sometimes and give them what they need, when they need it, with efficiency and expertise, so they can make that informed decision at the end of that. Sometimes I can hear people out discussing energy or other areas. You just say, you're tying a customer knots. They don't need to know this. It's too complicated. So strip it back, make it clear, and then there's no problem with transparency at that point as well.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So just moving on now then, folks, to the last question. I've had a couple of questions thrown at me in the comments, but I've got this is the last question that we've got, and I just want to start with you then, Shah. So what changes do you think we'll see across the market in the next few years? So we've looked backwards as to where the market's been. We're talking in the here and now a little bit today, but where do you think the market's going to go in the next sort of 5 years or so?
Well, my responses to this are quite generic because nobody's got this infamous crystal ball. I've only we'd had that 2 years ago. So I personally feel there'll be less consultants in the market, or certainly brokers, TPIs in the market. I think we'll see reduction in that. I think that our performance, both as partners and suppliers, will have to increase again for transparency. I think the drivers of legislation need to interact more comprehensively, because we don't want to get to a position where legislation has been made just for the sake of making it. We need to make sure that the customers are protected, the partners are protected, the suppliers are protected, as is best for everybody. I think our marketplace will be trading with more customer confidence if these other things are put in place, particularly this relationship piece that we've covered. And we need, as Wayne said, we need knowledgeable and informed people with professionals within our business to go out there and sort of eradicate any historical.
Thanks, Sean. And Wayne, what's your thoughts on that? What do you think the future's looking like?
Yeah, a few diverse things, I guess I'd say. So, yeah, obviously the buyers will remain hugely engaged, and that will grow. I think we're going to see a big shift in terms of the down through the marketplace in terms of the appetite for highly validated, credible renewables supply, and obviously we're going to see a lot more renewables come onto the grid, a lot more on-site renewables, and a lot more interactions with the grid, including localized battery storage, I would have thought as well. So it's that makes your supplier relationships more complex. It makes the customers absolutely naturally have to be better informed to operate in that way. So there'll be more customer complexity. From a supplier perspective, at the moment, and you know, some of you may have seen the, some of the articles that I've posted, but I for me, energy supplier customer service at the moment is at rock bottom. And that's evidenced by the Institute of Customer Services as well. That has got to improve. It's absolutely got to improve. The there's been a drain of good people out of the sector, which means that customers that have high expectations from other businesses that they interact with, they are getting it from certain suppliers in the utilities business, but in the main, they're not. The other thing is to bear in mind that in a sales process, you're not now just competing with other energy suppliers, you're competing with other providers of devices. Of you know, efficiency, storage, assets, whatever it might be, that customers can either choose, am I going to try and get my energy price down, or actually am I going to do going to try and get my energy consumption down and reduce costs in that way? So you're not competing in a traditional way. So you've got to bear that in mind in terms of when you create your propositions of how compelling is it versus the other things that a customer can spend their money on.
Great. Thanks, Wayne. And then James, you.
Yeah, I think I'd probably come at this from a slightly different perspective in the sense that I'm kind of thinking more about what is the future market trends in kind of the technology side of things. What will we be using? Probably bang the drum slightly for AI a bit here because I let the side down before. But I think you know the stark reality is that you know climate scientists agree you know temperatures are rising. They're due to rise to at least 2.5 degrees. And I think that creates the urgency. And I think whether you kind of follow climate science or anything like that, regulation will push businesses down a route to find more clean energy sources. And I think we really need to be aware of that. And I think AI has a role in both kind of easing the burden on the grid, which is quite important for large energy users like Microsoft, for example, whereby, you know, we really want to be a good neighbor. We want to make sure that we're not taking a huge amount from the grid and we're reinvesting in the grid where we can. And I think AI has a role in supporting that from real-time data using smart meters, sensors, and batteries. I think it will help grid operators balance supply and demand fundamentals and prevent some outages as well. And I think that's quite important, particularly in countries where that's a big challenge. And I think it also has predictive capabilities. We know AI can be used to predict energy supply and demand. So I think the transition to renewable sources and reducing emissions, I think is going to be quite critical. Although, obviously, don't ask it to predict football, not this tournament anyway. Far too many variables. And I think from Microsoft's perspective, I'd really like to see a market for hourly match renewable energy, which is quite relevant for Microsoft's 100-100-0 goal. So for 2030. So it's 100% of the electrons we use 100% of the time come from zero carbon sources. So having a market whereby you don't just identify where the generation is coming from, you can match it by the hour. I think that's really critical. And I think there are a few organizations now that are really the vanguards in this, but it really needs others to kind of come in and support that transition and really support that kind of better greening of the market. So we'll certainly see that, as well as a lot of changes to regulate the regulatory landscape. I've talked about that before, but we're seeing in the EU, and it's undoubtedly going to be influencing UK legislation too, you know, mandatory requirements around roof-mounted solar. So if you have a certain size building, you have to have solar. We're seeing a lot of legislation around heat reuse as well. So I think we'll see more on that. So there's quite a bit there, I think, that we'll see shifts towards new technologies and enhancing the technologies that we have.
Great, thanks, James. And I think if I was to summarize the answers we've got there, they've already focused on raising standards. So whether it's the way in which we sell or what we're selling or the people within our organizations from a service perspective, what we're talking about in the future is that standards have to be raised to deliver net zero challenges, to deliver targets for our own businesses and back to our customers as well, whether they be businesses in their own rights or residential consumers. So some really positive answers there. So we've got a couple of questions in the comments. While I'm going through those, if anybody wants to be brave enough to raise their hand and ask a question and unlock the video camera, then just put your hand up in the using the sort of hand up option, and we'll come to you after we've done these questions. We've got a few more minutes left anyway. So if anybody wants to ask the panel another question, then great. We've had one question focused on recruitment. So we've talked about really good people. And this question is really focused on, how do you ask questions in interviews? Or are there any sort of good interview questions that start to unearth the really good talent, whether it's sort of from a sales background or otherwise? Has anybody got some really good interview questions that they've asked over the years that's really helped in unearthing that?
If you're talking purely from a selling perspective, the one for me that was almost like the golden bullet was, tell me how you get around a not interested objection, because you'll weed out 80% of the people that can't really sell straight away, because most of them will come back with, well, what is it you're not interested in, which is not the question you want to be asking. So, I won't go too far into this, Ian, but there's elements of acknowledging and probing and isolating certain, things the barriers that could, that person would need to get past. So that one was always sort of, we used to joke about it, like the golden bullet. But there was other questions, probably more for cultural stuff. And I'm trying to think of some stuff off the top of my head, like asking about, tell me one thing that you didn't like about your previous manager, for example. And that helped with sort of cultural based stuff, because you'd be amazed how many people get really comfortable with that question and just fully open up and start telling everyone how bad their manager was. And you can get a feel for how they would be in the new culture. So they're the two I would share now.
Yeah, good couple of questions there. Anybody else got any corkers?
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's a corker, but I'll give you my view. I think if you're specifically looking for salespeople, naturally you want to find out what their achievements are, but behind it, you want to know how they've got that achievement. So anyone that claims, oh yeah, I'm just an amazing salesperson, I did it all myself, it's all my own, credited to me, that's rubbish, because I don't think anyone can sell solo robustly. So what I then ask is, okay, did you achieve? And if so, how did you achieve? And what I'd be looking for is how they worked the sales process, because the worst salespeople for me are the ones that do make the sales but then leave a trail of debris in the background, poor contract management, poor pricing, whatever it might be, that you then have to fix post-event, and that takes a long time. So I want to see people that not only do they achieve, but they achieve in the right way by following the process, putting all the steps in place, having all the right documentation, so that when they complete the sale, it is truly a completed, robust sale that you can then start to focus on delivering that service to them, to the customer.
That's a good one. Gemma, you look like you want to jump in.
I think Pete absolutely nailed it with questions that start with tell me. And I think for me, a really good killer question when you're interviewing for sales is, tell me what you think makes a good salesperson. I think you can gain a lot of insight into what people's answers is. I think the right answer is the ability to be curious and the ability to listen. And I think if someone has those two core skills, then what you're looking at then is training and refining that. But if someone is personable, curious, and has the ability to listen, you've nailed it. And questions that start, as Pete said, with tell me, whichever avenue you're trying to steer your interview process down, they're the way to go.
Cool.
Ian, I have got another one, which I think actually is a corker that came to me as I was thinking about it. So someone that I worked with, they would always finish an interview with this question and then stay entirely silent and leave it to the candidate. Is there something you're not telling me? And leave it at that. And you get some quite interesting answers that come on the back of it. Sometimes they say, no, it's fine, I'm not telling. There's sometimes someone will reveal something that they think you know, but that you don't know, and that gives you some quite useful behind the CV insights.
Wow, that made me feel anxious, even though I'm not in an interview.
Yeah, I was going to say more of an interrogation. Just to jump on one of Gemma's points quickly, in regards to I lost my train of thought now. I was too busy thinking about I was too busy worried about Wayne's line of questioning. Something to do with the oh yeah, so like sales for me in its most purest form is questioning techniques and listening skills. So
I agree.
it's if you can find a set of questions that can allow you to understand, is this person a good listener? Do they listen when they need to listen? Do they engage when they need to engage? And then when they do engage, are they asking the right questions? Are they using open questions when they need to use open questions? Are they deflecting statements? Are they using closed questions towards the end of the call and stuff like that? So obviously a lot of that stuff can be taught as well. But I think Gemma touched on some of the you've got to find somebody with the right foundational base to be able to work with and develop. But they're the two things that we kind of look for: listening skills and questioning techniques.
Oh, okay.
That's the perfect answer, I think.
Thanks, Jim.
So I think we're pretty much running out of time now. So we have one more question that we had that I'll come back to the group with some answers on. I just want to thank the panelists first of all. Some really good thought-provoking answers today. Some really good experience being shared in. And I suppose that was, my big hope for today from a future leader's perspective is that we were able to pass things around and share some knowledge and leave a bit of a legacy so that other people, either new in sales or looking to develop some sales knowledge and skills, were able to pick some things up today, practical and some theory as well, and take that back into the day jobs or the next job. So I just want to thank you all for being able to share that. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Now we've had some thumbs up and some emojis there, which is always a good sign. And for everybody for joining us today, thank you for joining us on this Future Leaders webinar. If you're interested in learning more about Future Leaders Mentoring, then please check out our website, which is www.futureleadersmentoring.com, or take a look at our LinkedIn page where we have loads of interactive discussions and we share lots about our mentoring on our other events. So for now, thank you and goodbye.